The format tonight, we thought we'd like to take a very few minutes among the three of us and tell you a little bit about our trips to Central America, when we went, how long we were there, who we were with, and just maybe a few words about what we saw the church doing and involved in Nicaragua, perhaps broaden that to other parts of Central America, and then open it up for us to have a general discussion, for you to ask questions, and all of us to be engaged in some conversation. So we've agreed among the three of us that we will take no more than 7 minutes apiece, 5, 7 minutes. So we'll have plenty of time for discussion. So, begin.
I went to Nicaragua about a year ago now at this time, and spent about a week there, a little over a week, for the purpose of talking to people in that place about the situation in the country. A good deal of that had to do with the church in Nicaragua. We talked to people, some of whom were Protestant, some of whom were Roman Catholic. The principal, or the majority of those Christians in Nicaragua, of course, are Roman Catholic. High percentage of them are. I think something like 90% of the Christians in Nicaragua are Roman Catholic, over and against about 10%, as I understand it. My perception of the church in that place focused around two elements of the church, and maybe I could describe what those are, because I think it would be helpful to then discuss my perceptions about it. First of all, the hierarchical church, that is the structure of church in Nicaragua, and then the other was the popular church, something that is called the popular church, which is made up essentially of base Christian communities and other Christians that are associated with the base Christian community movement, the liberation theology, if we can call it a movement in Latin America. Those in the church that are more closely associated with and have identified with the struggles of the poor in Latin America. So on one hand, not always in tension, but certainly in Nicaragua at this point in tension, the hierarchical church and what is called the popular church. We heard that at this point, which is a year ago, as I mentioned, that at the time of the revolution in Nicaragua, the hierarchical church was quite supportive of the revolutionary government and of the revolutionary process. But that since that time, there has been a moving away from the revolutionary government. That is, the support of the hierarchical church is now waning somewhat for the for support of the Nicaraguan government. Not so with the popular church, as we saw it there at that time. The popular church, that is the grassroots church, continues to be very supportive of the Nicaraguan government, the revolutionary government. And of course, getting back to the hierarchical church, we have seen through the events that surrounded the Pope's visit this last spring that, in fact, that is borne out, that the hierarchical church is becoming less and less supportive of the Nicaraguan revolutionary government. We had a chance to attend a church service one morning in a poor neighborhood in Managua. We dropped in. When I say we, it was about 10 or maybe 15 of the Americans in our group. I'm sure that there was some trepidation among this local Catholic parish when 15 North Americans walked in. I'm sure they thought maybe this is the American invasion coming or something. So we could sense a little bit of what is happening. Why this? Because I'm sure that was quite extraordinary. The priest that morning set that at ease when he said that told the people of the parish, if these people were not interested in what we are doing, and they are, I would affirm that. He said they would have stopped in Acapulco on the way down. And that brought the roof down, and it then suddenly opened the door for what turned out to be just a marvelous communion that we had with that group of people. Part of the worship service being one of persons from within the congregation there standing up to give testimony, much of which involved their Christian witness, I'd almost have to say, regarding their lives, some of it which dealt with day-to-day things, some of which dealt with their feeling for a new life under the new revolutionary situation that they have. So that very much affirmed for us the fact that that in fact, at least in that place, the popular church, or the grassroots church, I should say, is very, very supportive of what is taking place there. That there is a considerable sense of freedom there that they are experiencing that they had not experienced before the revolution under the conditions of the dictatorship of the Somoza regime. So we enjoyed that. And a couple of our group also stood up and spoke to the group. And it turned out just to be a marvelous experience for us. And just after that worship service, I had the chance to visit with a Boy Scout troop that had been there, and I was impressed at how similar their Boy Scout activities were to ours. And that was kind of a neat experience also. That's pretty much, that's at least some of what we experienced there.
Do you have a language carrier there? Do you speak Spanish?
I do not speak Spanish, but we had a number in our group that did, and so consequently we had just a constant state of interpretation, and it worked out quite well. I wish very, very much that I did speak Spanish.
You're going to do it well when you do it. I like the way you say Nicaragua.
Well,
you got that nice roll.
I do that so that, yeah. I don't know, you pretend to it. Take that on, I guess.
Yes, you do. Thank you. Spence?
Okay, I'm Spencer, Dan Spencer. My experience is both a little more indirect and a little more direct than I think either Pat or Dick, in that it's been a little longer since I was there, but I have spent a total of over a year in Costa Rica, which is the country neighboring Nicaragua to the south. I was there in 1978 for 5 months, which was when the Sandinista revolution really began to pick up, and then I was there last year for 8 months studying in a seminary. There were several Nicaraguan students in the seminary whom I got to know quite well. I traveled in Nicaragua for about a week and a half, but not on any organized sort of thing, mostly visiting families of the students that I stayed with, talking with Christian pastors, but very informal, so it was much more of a tourist type thing, although being fluent in Spanish and having contacts in there made quite a difference. The other perspective I have that is a little different is while I was in Costa Rica, I spent 5 months working with refugee children from El Salvador, and which tied in with some very interesting perspectives on Nicaragua as well. I would just say that I'll talk a little bit about this later, but the view of Nicaragua among the poor in Central America is very different from what I could gather than the view we get in the press. And Nicaragua, for at least the Salvadoran refugees who I spoke with, were mostly landless, poor, peasant folk, is that Nicaragua is really seen as their beacon of hope. They are put so much faith and hope in what is happening in Nicaragua. Most of them, to get to Costa Rica, had to travel through Nicaragua, talk with many of the people there, compare their own situations of poverty and oppression in El Salvador with the history of Nicaragua and what's happening now in Nicaragua. And talking with these people, talking with the refugees, who it's hard to even begin to think about what they had been through before they had gotten to Costa Rica, but to to watch the change in their face and their eyes lit up as they would talk about Nicaragua was one of the most emotional experiences I've had. So that, I think, was a real key lesson of learning the difference in perspective and depending on who is viewing Nicaragua and from where. I won't say a whole lot more than that now. Just that is what my context is. I know the church much better in Costa Rica, but in the seminary where I was studying, there were students from 30 different Latin American countries. So I got a fairly broad view, at least from their personal stories, of what was happening. I also had the chance while I was in Nicaragua to get to the Atlantic coast, which for, I don't know how many people here are familiar with Central America, but most of the Caribbean coast in Central America is populated by black people, primarily from Jamaica, primarily English speaking. And so it's a very different, geographically, culturally, everything is very different than the Spanish, Hispanics, eastern side or western coast.
Thank you, Spence. I was in Nicaragua just this past June with a group of 22 persons, mostly from Iowa and Minnesota. The tour was organized by the Newman Center at the University of Minnesota, and the program was put together by the Center for Global Service and Education, which is associated with Augsburg College in Minneapolis. We spent about 5 days in Mexico and about 5 days in Honduras and then about 10 days in Nicaragua. Our group was a very ecumenical group. We had a large number of Roman Catholics, of Lutherans, of Methodists, a Presbyterian woman pastor, an Episcopalian pastor. Three members of our tour were Jews. And they were lay people and clergy. Our youngest person had just graduated from Luther College this last May, and our oldest person was retiring at the end of this coming academic year. So we had quite a perspective. Of the 22 of us, 21 were American, and one was an Uruguayan young woman who was a Fulbright exchange student at the University of Minnesota, who very much wanted to go to Nicaragua and see that situation for herself before she returned to Uruguay. The main purpose of the trip was similar to Dick's in that we wanted to go down and find out what was happening in that country, the relationship between what we were hearing about in the United States and what was really going on there, but also to see especially the work of the church and its work in development and relief activities in Mexico and Honduras and in Nicaragua. We met not only we had the opportunity to be in a congregation also, which was a very rich experience, and I can share some of that later, but we met with the organized church groups in Nicaragua, a group called CPOD, which is a group of evangelical Protestant churches that was formed in 1972 at the time of the devastating earthquake in Managua, and that has continued to work in the area of development in Nicaragua. They are currently involved in working with about 25,000 people or 3,000 families hurt in the revolution. This is over and above their regular program of development activities. What they told us was interesting, that there is freedom of religion in Nicaragua, that all church groups may practice their worship and hold services as we would here in the United States with no restrictions at all. But that more than that, there was a very close working relationship between the churches. Some of the church organizations like CPOD and the government, that the government was open to critiques of its own activities by church people. And nowhere did we hear this more true than in relationship to the Mosquito Indian controversy, which happened very soon after the revolution, after the overthrow of Somoza in 79. And if you're interested, I can say a little bit more about that later. It is true what Dick said, that there is a split in the Roman Catholic Church, the hierarchy of the church led by Archbishop Obrando Bravo has grown progressively anti the Sandinista Front, the revolutionary government, and most of the bishops in the major provinces of Nicaragua are also anti the Sandinista revolution, whereas you find many of the parish priests, if not the majority of them, are working quite closely with the revolutionary government at city level, at province level, as well as at national level. The split is now also becoming deeper within the Protestant church. The group that we spoke to, CEPAD, is very much supportive in a critical way, meaning dialoguing way over against the government. But there are other evangelical Protestant groups which are against the revolutionary process. These tend to be groups related to the more fundamentalist groups in the United States who are concerned that religion is a matter of saving souls and doesn't have anything to do with people's bodies or lifestyles. This conflict in both the Roman Catholic Church and the Protestant Church is taking a great deal of energy from both churches in Nicaragua right now. But what was interesting to us is that the conflict goes on very publicly in the church and in the country. I would just like to say again one point that Dick made in a presentation earlier last week, and that is the number of Christians who are involved either in positions of responsibility in the Nicaraguan government or in related activities to it, like Sister Mary Hartman, who is a Mary Knoll sister, who's a member of the Human Rights Commission in Nicaragua. So I think I'll just stop there and throw it open for questions, comments, discussion.
Why is there the growing opposition with the Protestant Church? Do they feel that it's becoming a Marxist government, what is their feeling? Why are they opposed to it?
It's a couple of different things, and maybe Dick can help me with this, and Spence too. The Roman Catholic Church is being confronted now in Nicaragua very directly with the question of privilege and power. It partakes of the whole revolution that the Roman Catholic Church has been undergoing for the last 20 years, where the decision is, shall we be on the side of the wealthy and those who have high status and power in the country, or will we be on the side of the liberation movements, the poor and the oppressed, the peasants and the working people? Archbishop Obrando Bravo has become used to having his way, and he is really, frankly, in a power conflict with the government leaders in the Sandinista government, who say, yes, we must work together for the good of all of the people of Nicaragua, and no one has any more power or privilege than anyone else. That's just one source of the conflict, is that having to give up a place that you've always had. As far as we can tell, he lives in real isolation, physically, from almost everybody. He refuses to meet with any groups, whether they are friendly or unfriendly to the Sandinista regime. Those who are also opposed to the Sandinista government are struggling with the question of whether the Sandinistas are carrying out their original convictions fast enough. I think this is a kind of internal critical dialogue that's going on in the country that says you can't turn all of your attention to the matter of self-defense, even though you're being severely pressed by the United States and by the Contra activities from Honduras. You have to also pay attention to the original goals and ideas of the revolution. And there's a real struggle here. Nicaragua declared a state of emergency in 1981, so everybody up front knows that there's this big crisis going on. But there's still a struggle inside about whether some of the choices that the Sandinistas are making are good and necessary choices. For example, they do have censorship of the press, which they all reminded us the United States had during Second World War II, when we were in a state of national emergency. And the churches, in some cases, are quite critical of this press censorship, feeling that the Sandinistas are losing more on the in the world international opinion as well as in the country by having press censorship than they're gaining by the press censorship. They say that the reason that they are censoring the press now is because there is a state of tension and crisis in the country, and that some of the newspapers are taking advantage of this and creating a more emotional climate in the country than is good for the climate, I mean, is good for the people to have. For example, before one of the things which led them to begin the censorship process was one of the newspapers ran an article about food shortages in the country. There were not any food shortages when the newspaper ran the article, but the result of the article was a food shortage because people panicked and went into the store and started buying a lot of stuff and hoarding things, and the shortages in specific commodities developed. So, you know, that's a long-winded answer. Do you have anything to add to that, Dick?
The Archbishop of Managua has been identified, I think, somewhat with the conservative sectors within Nicaragua, and before the revolution was quite supportive of the revolution, as were the conservative sectors of Nicaragua. Now the conservative sectors within that country are becoming somewhat dissatisfied. The well-to-do within the private sector generally are finding that they are having some restrictions put on them. And I think that identification continues to be, there continues to be an identification with the Archbishop and those sectors. So there isn't an inconsistency there, but I think that's part of it. I think another part of it is that I think that the hierarchical church in Latin America is having some problems with the popular church. I think there's a natural tension there that we see taking place in Nicaragua. It certainly is taking place that the hierarchical church sees the popular church as being somewhat threatening to the unity of the Catholic Church in Latin America. I think that plays into that as well.
I just wanted to point out one thing along that too, that in all these questions it's very helpful to have some historical context to understand what is going on. And Dick was bringing up a point there that as far as the church in Latin America, primarily the Roman Catholic Church, for several hundred years there's been a fairly tight alliance in nearly all the Latin American countries between the Roman Catholic Church, the government of the country, and the military of the country. And traditionally the wealth of the country has been concentrated in that alliance. What's happening in Nicaragua is very different in the sense that the the popular church has sprung up again among the poorest of the poor. It tends to spring up in local neighborhoods. It's where people gather together in small groups and they reflect on the scripture and the Bible in the context of their day-to-day reality. That is precisely a lot of the area that the Sandinista governments are working in. So there's been a shift in terms of who the government is allied with. And it's no longer allied with the privileged class. It's much more allied with the poorer classes. The church, the more conservative members of the church, tend to view this as the Sandinistas exploiting that to divide the church. I mean, what you hear a lot of times is that the government is trying to separate the base of the church from the hierarchy. And so it's a very painful process right now, the church struggling with its identity of who, as Pat was pointing out, a real power question. But it's happening almost in every country without fail in Latin America now as a consequence of the commitment to the poor that has been taken officially by the bishops in the last 15 years. Trying to figure out how you put that commitment in practice. It sounds great on paper, but when you put it in practice, you inevitably get factions and divisions.
What is the ratio? You speak of the poor hierarchy. What ratio are we talking about?
I don't have the statistics for Nicaragua, but I was in the Dominican Republic, which, and it's fairly typical for this situation in Latin America. There's a tremendous shortage of clergy. In Dominican Republic, there are about 6 million Roman Catholics, and there are about 450 priests for that 6 million people. The average parish size is about 80,000. Of those 450 priests, only 150 of them are born in the Dominican Republic. The other 300 are missionaries, usually from Spain, Canada, or the United States. So you have a situation set up where people may see a priest or a clergy member once a year. So you have a tremendous base and a very small hierarchy and a lot of power invested in a very few number of people. In most of the countries, the clergy is made up of people who come from middle to upper class, the educated class. And that's the kind of dynamic that sets up. Now, the thing that is very threatening that I find extremely exciting about the popular church is the amount of lay leadership that goes on. This is people in their local neighborhoods working not against the priests and the clergy, but working among themselves so that they are no longer waiting for the once a year visit of the priest. But this, on the other hand, is very threatening to a group of 400 men who have been used to running a country.
What's the position of the Pope in all this?
I'd like to ask a question on the very poor.
We really
just
should.
One second, we need to address this. Okay.
We need to respond to that. We all laughed, I think, because it's so sad. Frustrating. The position of the Pope is really what Spence said, to be somewhat afraid of the popular church, because it and to perceive it as a threat. And during his visit to Central America, he, in almost all of his locations, reinforced the hierarchy and called on the people to pay attention to the hierarchy. Either ignored the popular church altogether or sometimes, in fact, put it down. So it was really a great disappointment to the people because he didn't seem to be very responsive to the kind of situation that they find themselves in.
When he was in Mexico, didn't he ask that the church have more compassion for the poor and the jobless? he's sitting on the fence telling the poor what they'd like to hear and then supporting the hierarchy in the church.
It's complex. I'm Roman Catholic, so I sort of put up with or do this a little differently. I think the Pope sees a lot of things through his own situation in Poland, where a united church is very crucial to the situation of the people. Yeah, I think if you look at the what he preached in each different country in Central America, his message in Nicaragua was very pointed. He talked, and in other places, he talked a lot about poverty and oppression and so forth, the need to overcome that. In Nicaragua, he didn't address that issue very much, talked almost specifically about church unity. And his point was clear. He did not want, he was very, felt very threatened by the base church there. I feel that, you know, I mean, I have problems with the Pope in a lot of areas, and I was very disappointed in that. One of the things that I find tremendously exciting about the lay church is the role of women. It's the one area where women are very much leadership oriented. That's, you know, and the Pope has different views on women than I do as well. I visited the Dominican Republic and in Nicaragua and in Costa Rica. All three areas where I visited base Christian communities and worshiped with them, the role of women was extremely exciting. And the way that, what I don't mean to dodge the Pope issue, anything, but just as we're talking about this, the spirituality that is developing in these communities is so all-embracing. It's, I think, a much more biblical or Hebraic spirituality in the sense of developing the wholeness of life. And these people come together and they face the issues that face their communities. And I think, particularly in the women, I was struck by this, that there's tremendous alcoholism among the men in Central America. Women do about 80% of the work. It's just, and they come together and reflect on this, and the things that happen out of this in terms of the wholeness of life and pressing for change is just unbelievable. I talked with a number of people in Nicaragua and have read a lot where they are really focusing on the areas of Exodus and the wilderness in the Bible as where they draw on their spiritual norms, because they really view having gone through 40 years of Somoza, the Somoza regime, and now they've gone through their Exodus period of the revolution, and now they really view themselves as in a wilderness period where they are in a totally new era. They have very little guidelines. They are drawing on their faith to sustain them in a period of tremendous hostility with little resources and little help. And I was just overwhelmed with the spiritual strength of these people that are dealing with so much and face so much.
Sir, you had a question.
Are you talking, which group of people are you talking about? We're talking about the Catholics, but the middle class, the higher, more wealthy people, or how about the very poor people? How do they fit into this picture? They care what's going on down there, whether they belong to one group of government or another?
In the Nicaraguan situation, when we speak of the base Christian community, the popular church, it tends to be identified with the poor people of Nicaragua. As I recall, most of the Catholic schools, Roman Catholic schools, are attended by the somewhat upper class. So I think generally there's a general identification with the hierarchical church and the people that are better off in Nicaragua. The base Christian communities are more associated with the poor.
Well, at one time, the Catholic Church, oh, this has been, maybe it's still true today, but my brother-in-law was down in Central America, South America. And the Catholic Church, especially amongst the poor, they kind of, these poor people who have been Catholics for maybe hundreds of years, the church was still carrying on some of the ideas that went back before the Reformation. Like he said, at one time there was a certain holiday down there in South America, where they would make wax statues, and then they'd sell them to the people, the poor people, the Catholics. This kind of sounded like at the time of Luther, with selling indulgences and so forth for the building of St. Peter's in Rome. Is that still going on down there, or?
Oh, I don't think so in Nicaragua. It seems like there has, well, it not only seems like, but I think it's quite evident that the Roman Catholic Church in Latin America, in almost all of Latin America, has gone through a very dramatic change. And this is a relatively recent thing that has happened in the early 60s to mid 60s, following Vatican II in the early 60s. It all started to take place at that point in time. And I think that change in the Catholic Church has to be described as quite significant, to say the least. So this is a relative recent thing, but I think what you describe, where the Catholic Church has been more of a the historical vehicle for keeping people settled through religious control, I guess you could say, it doesn't exist there.
Yeah, well, this was 35 years ago, shortly after the Second World War.
This dramatic change is much more recent than that, within the last 20 years.
But what you say brings up an important point that I think we need to keep in mind. When we talk about the church, or the church in general, it's important that we don't associate with the models that we have of churches in the United States, because it's a very different situation. It's predominantly Catholic, very large parishes with few clergy. The Protestants that do exist in Latin America, over 80% of the Protestants are Pentecostal. So when we think of mainline Protestantism here, whether it's Lutheran or Presbyterian or Methodist or whatever, that basically does not exist in Latin America. There are some exceptions, but basically it's a very different situation. And so it's hard to keep that in mind, but the idea of the Sunday church where you drive up in Sunday school and so forth, it's a very different reality there.
Are the schools parochial, like you talk about the leadership of the women are giving? Are they been educated? They must be educated in order to...
This is one of the exciting things about the base Christian communities, is that it is an education process. People are learning to read through this. People are learning to read, and at the same time that they're learning about their own situation. Dick has mentioned this before, but in the last 4 years, the illiteracy rate in Nicaragua has gone from about 50% down to about 10 to 12%. And a lot of this is, almost all of this is happening at the local level. I saw most directly in the Dominican Republic, but I know about elsewhere, is that what happens a lot of times is communities will start organizing, they'll start meeting, oftentimes purely a social level at first, but they'll begin to talk about their needs, not in any sophisticated sense of analysis, but people understand when alcoholism or lack of sewers or lack of paved road, or all these things, they talk about that. Out of that kind of dynamic, leadership emerges. One or two or three people will begin to emerge as leaders within the group. Very often, those people then will go on small sort of basic training courses, either to the larger city or center, where they will learn, get some of the materials, and start forming networks with other small groups throughout the country. And then they go back into their local situation and begin literacy groups, begin nutrition groups, begin childcare type things. And you just see this whole network building up. Tremendously exciting to see how people that were formerly isolated and despondent, had nothing to work with, are out of their own, and still having almost no resources, but still out of getting together and working with visions, are really pulling themselves out.
And this material, does that come from the government? Is it available through the government if they want to use it?
Well, this is one of the things I find very exciting about Nicaragua, is it's one of the few countries in Latin America where there's a lot of interchanges happening between these local groups and the government. I mean, the government is very open and receptive to the kinds of projects that are going out. In many countries in Latin America, the local church, the base church, is viewed as a tremendous threat, and it's revolutionary to have a Bible. People traditionally did not read Bibles. Now the governments are associating the fact that people are having Bible with the fact that people are agitating for change. And so it's not an overstatement to say that in many areas of Latin America, it's revolutionary to be a Christian and to read the Bible. It's viewed as very threatening.
This more or less is related to what I was going to ask, but I've been interested in the bread, and I subscribe to Mary Old Father's Magazine and the Salesians, and they, of course, in our own Lutheran Standard and other Lutheran publications, and World Vision as well. It seems to be an increase throughout the world, and is it also in Latin America and Central America, and the increase of lay missionaries or lay people, and the results of, can you elaborate or give your viewpoints on that? Any of you? What you observed in that?
Did you talk with folks when you were down as a lay?
We talked with some. We talked more with organizational people than we did with a lot of lay people, except as we would meet them in our visits to various places. And I guess in my experience was not so much in Nicaragua as it was in Honduras, where the churches, again, there's a it really is a complex situation. It's hard to unpack. The church is involved with refugee work in Honduras, with development work. And by development work, I mean working in very poor neighborhoods with very fundamental issues like sewage and nutrition and vaccination programs for kids and literacy programs. Is that increasingly to be involved as a lay missioner in areas like Honduras is to be considered by the government very political. It's very hard to be neutral in situations like Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, because the mere fact of trying to help people change their lives is a threat to the status quo. And many people, as Dick has said earlier, have paid for that at the cost of their lives. There is a great tension among some of the groups that you mentioned, particularly World Vision. People are raising questions about what the effect of their work is in Central America. The people who are working in churches with refugees and with development work, like under an ecumenical group, and the Caritas, other organizations like that. So it's unclear. The situation is, one of the things I think we have to remember is that when we think about the work that our churches do here in the United States, we make an assumption about basic stability of government, which just doesn't exist in Central America, and the situation is very fluid and changing all the time. I don't know if anybody else wants to comment on that.
I just make one comment in terms of you asked about lay leadership. This again was something I saw more in the Dominican Republic, but it was extremely exciting to me. I mentioned that oftentimes these base groups will form in local neighborhoods, and then they begin to have contact with other base groups in a larger network form. When we were there, we went to a meeting of 30 representatives. Each person was a representative from a different group. And so we were in that group, there were representatives from 30 different groups, and in each group, it may be between 15 and 50 or something like that. So it's quite a large number, from mostly from very poor neighborhoods, but in a radius of maybe 5 or 10 miles. It was, and again, all of these were lay people, very exciting to talk with them. I'll mention two different things. Well, I already mentioned the fact that a tremendous number of women are involved. You see some of the same patterns in Latin America as you see in the United States, only more so in that congregations tend to be women and children, and leadership tends to be men. And this was, in particular in Costa Rica when I was there, it was so obvious to me because when I was there in 1978, I was living with a priest in a small town, and go to mass and the church would be full of women and the men would always be outside. Then Holy Week came along and there were important functions to be done and the men did all the parades and the women watched. Holy Week was over, the women went back to the church, the men went back to the street. So, but in this particular case, here were women in leadership positions and there were quite a few of them in quite a range in age, from teenage up to grandmothers. But the other thing that was very exciting was that even though I would say about 60 to 70% of the people in this particular meeting were women, there were also a number of men. And to have lay men being involved now in the church body is, as far as my experience, almost unheard of in Latin America. You are either, if you're a man in the church, you're in the clergy. And if you're not in the clergy, you just don't have much to do with the church for the most part. And that's not the same in Protestants, but in the Catholic Church. It's a very cultural thing. And so I was extremely excited to see the kind of barriers that were being broken down through this lay leadership. And the involvement of children too. There were 5 or 6 teenage leaders from teenage groups that were meeting together and reflect and doing more than, you know, playing softball together. I mean, they were getting together and really looking at what it was like to be a child, a teenager in a situation of poverty, and what it meant to be Christian. How did you reflect on that? So I came away from that just almost overwhelmed with the potential that people were experiencing.
Do you feel that the emphasis of being in that direction due to the decline in clergy?
That is one factor that is very, very important, yeah.
That seems to be from all directions.
It's a combination of a reawakening of the church and realizing that the needs of the church are not going to be met through ordained clergy. And with that combination, people are looking for other alternatives.
So I'd like to make a comment before Janelle answer your question. My impression of the churches that we visited all throughout Latin America was one of a very youthful church. The youth are very much involved in the church. And I, for one, was just staggered to learn that the average age in Nicaragua is 14. That says something about that country and its youthful leadership and the youth space that it has to speak to and who's involved in this revolutionary struggle. You know?
I was just wondering, thinking of Rios Montt and Guatemala being pink customers. And you also just mentioned, if you're not remembering, what people are being cosplayed in the world, and also what influence the American pink-cosplayed church has had on the people in Central America.
I can say some things. This is a very interesting question that you bring up. The question is concerns the Pentecost. She asked about former President Rios Montt in Guatemala, who was thrown out in a coup recently, but was associated with the Pentecostal fundamentalist church out of California. And she asked what. I had mentioned that if you weren't Catholic in Latin America, chances are you were Pentecostal. And she asked what the makeup of that was and what connections it has with North American spaces. Very interesting. The Pentecostal movement, very much like in the United States, in Latin America, tends to be very popular with the poor people. It's a very spirited movement. People are
the meeting typically lasts for hours, a lot of singing. It's a typical response to severe oppression. If people respond in that kind of manner, the ties with the United States are very strong and very direct, and it depends a lot on which country. There's some countries more. Guatemala has been targeted by many of the groups in the United States as an important mission field. Tremendous amounts of money being poured into Guatemala. I can't remember the statistic either, but there are more Protestant missionaries than there are Catholic priests in Guatemala, even though the makeup of the country is far the greater Catholic than Protestant. The interesting thing that comes along with this, I think is tragic, is that a lot of North American baggage goes down over the border. And I had a very interesting experience in Costa Rica because my language training was done in a school which trains missionaries for Latin America. And about 90% of those missionaries are from very conservative Bible churches. Mostly from the south, but they are very, very strong on separation of politics and state, or church and state. But that distinction that we have in our heritage up here is just not applicable to Latin America, where you have a totally different situation. But when that kind of message gets preached in a situation like Nicaragua, it becomes counterproductive because they are preaching to the people, do not do anything with the Sandinista government. And so you get this split developing that is very detrimental. So with the conservative Pentecostal-oriented, Bible-oriented churches there, I'm very weary from the experiences I had. It's a very spiritualistic message that does not deal with the reality of the people. And I think in some of the other situations, we're getting a much more holistic sense of what it means to be spiritual. Physical needs, emotional needs, spiritual needs, all combined.
What about the Lutherans? Are they having any success down there or not?
I don't know what you mean by success.
are they getting some converts?
Their presence.
People would have more of the Lutherans probably than I do. They're combining what is over
there. I could speak a little bit about that. I don't have strong, but generally in Central America, there is relatively little Lutheran presence. Phil Anderson, who is working now with the ALC and probably LCU and primarily those bodies, is spending a good deal of time now in Central America gathering information that will be used then to assess the extent to which the Lutheran Church and the ways in which the Lutheran Church might become more involved in Central America. So right now I would say the Lutheran Church is going through a period of evaluation with regard to its presence there. But I think it's accurate that the Lutheran presence in Central America has been quite limited.
Well, I do know that the Catholic Church has been the predominant church down there, of course. Any of the poorer people down there, of course, are Catholics because their parents were Catholics and their parents were poor. Just like that I'm a Lutheran because maybe my parents were Lutherans, my foreparents were Lutherans, and so forth. But it's very difficult to try to come in there, another group, like say a Lutheran group, to get a foothold in there amongst these Catholic people. Whether that is the right thing to do, I don't know, but it is.
I would just make a couple of comments. Lutheran World Relief, which is an organization with which some of you may be familiar, the relief organization of the Lutheran churches, cooperates quite fully with the ecumenical organizations in Central America, specifically in Honduras and Nicaragua, both where we work. Money from Lutheran World Relief goes to support development projects in both of those countries. But in terms of Lutheran churches, there are very small Lutheran churches, and they are related if they have any connections at all to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in the United States, rather than to the AOC or LCA or AES.
I've lived in Peru now for 7 years, and we are trying to open, we've had kind of like a little mission going for about a year now, where just to back up what you're saying, we have maybe 15 to 20 women who come from, we live in a real poor neighborhood, they come twice a week to learn about nutrition, to learn about sewing and knitting and crocheting, anything that can help them save money for raising their children, because everyone has lots of children. And like you say too, they have easily drunk husbands or husbands that beat them. And I've really seen a big effect just in 1 year. We're like a real strong core now, and the women are finding out there are about 3 of them that can't read or write, so we've been trying to teach them that. The kids, they send all their kids, some of the women that don't even come to our group, send their kids to the Sunday school that we have every Sunday morning, and it starts at 10 o'clock, but those kids are there at 8:30 knocking on the door. Mm-hmm. And they're supposed to go, you know, in an hour and a half, and they leave about 1 o'clock, you know, to go home for lunch. You have to just kind of push them out the door because they don't want to leave.
Say again where that is?
In Peru.
Oh.
In the southernmost city on the Chilean border.
Mm-hmm.
So I can really see there's a real hunger for learning, and then we give little Bible classes too, kind of stuck in there, you know. So in order to attract them to come to the house, we started with these different craft classes, and then kind of sneak the Bible classes in between them. It's really, really, really working. I can really see a change in the women. And if you change the women, you change their whole family.
Oh,
that's true. Because they're the strong ones. Like you say, they're the ones that earn, they're the earners. They earn all the money. They have most control over their children. And so that's why the husbands end up beating them, because that's the only way that they have to power over their wife. They scare them. So we get together on all those things, you know, the different, sometimes the wife will be booted out of her house and she'll come and have a place to stay. It's really a wide spread. Yeah. You can really help in a lot of ways.
Comments were made early on that you went down to check out the situation for real, compared to what you read in U.S. media. Would you care to elaborate specifically on perhaps your biggest surprises, if there were any?
Oh yes, I had some really major surprises. First of all, I found the situation very different from what the United States establishment press describes it. In my own understanding, I did not find a totalitarian society or situation. We found a country that is under great attack by the United States, the giant to the north, as they call it. But a country that is as free a society as I've ever been in my life. And where just on the personal level, two things I experienced. One was that freedom. I mean, I've lived in the United States all my life, and my family goes back a long, long way in this country. But I have never seen people as excited about being free and as intentional about claiming their freedom as I found in Nicaragua. They have fought for that, they have died for that, they have struggled for that, and they are holding on to that because it is literally the most precious thing they have, the right to make their own decisions and the right to work to improve their own lives. And to have control over their own destiny. And that has a kind of energy and contagion about it, even in the face of the grimmest reality. One of the other things that we felt were just the incredible number of no-win situations that the Nicaraguans are in. I mean, just constantly being faced with choices, both of which are terrible, and yet somehow in the middle of these terrible choices, persevering with courage and reality and absolute conviction about freedom. The second thing that I found, which moved me so deeply, was an experience of the success of improving the lot of the poor, or what we would call the struggle for justice. Lyndon Johnson named it in the United States the Great Society. But I literally saw in Nicaragua the evidence of people who've learned how to read, people who are healthy now because they have medical care, people who have food to eat, who have jobs to work, who have housing that's decent, safe, and sanitary to live in. I mean, all of the most basic kinds of human needs have been met or are being met in Nicaragua in the last 4 years in a way that is unlike any other Latin American country. And that is what I think represents the new alternative and why the experiment is so exciting, both for the people in Nicaragua and for all of the people in other countries, is because they've been able to see the people in El Salvador and Guatemala and Costa Rica and Mexico, all up and down South America, that people really can change their lives and conditions can improve. I don't know whether that answers your question, but it was really exciting to see.
One other thing I wanted to add to that, I would affirm what Pat has said, but one thing that was terribly refreshing for me was the openness and the feeling of honesty that you feel in talking to those that are involved in that revolutionary process. And I suspect that perhaps is maybe an attribute that is common to people that have come through a process like that where any sort of mask just isn't appropriate in that situation. I had the feeling, and I think this is kind of a common experience, that we could talk about anything, ask any question whatsoever without even a highly critical question of the standards of the government, and feel comfortable about it, and feel that, in fact, the answer we were getting at the time was very heartfelt by the person that was responding. So that was a strong impression I had, was a very, very great openness to that kind of dialogue, which is what we went there principally for anyway. So that was kind of a very big plus for me to experience that.
How did the government, or how did the people that you talked to view the U.S. government?
The view generally that we detected was that there was a very warm feeling toward us as people. There was a minor trepidation, as I mentioned, as we went to that church. What are all the North Americans doing? You know, there's that just lingers, but that very quickly put aside, as I mentioned before. There's a feeling of warmth toward Americans as people, but there is a feeling of resentment and bitterness now on the part of the majority of people in Nicaragua toward the United States government and the present foreign policy of the United States. There's a resentment of that.
I'd like Spence to comment, but I'd like to say one thing about that. We were received even 2 months ago or in June with the warmest kind of hospitality that you can possibly imagine. I mean, they were eager to have us visit factories and farms and prisons and schools and office buildings, and welcomed us wherever we came and said, we want to tell you our story. We want you to be free to go anywhere you want to go and ask any questions you can, to go home and tell people what it really is like here. You know, say what you see. And they kept saying over and over again, we want peace. We don't want war with the United States. We would like to be your neighbors. We'd like to cooperate with you and to be able to learn from you and exchange from you. But we don't want to be dominated by you. And the United States government is really seen as a very threatening, negative presence.
Let me flip this thing, because when we left here a year ago, we did need visas. Now, since the United States has requested their consulate to leave, the sixth consulate in the United States, Nicaragua's response has been, Americans will no longer need visas to come to Nicaragua. That's their response. Unless, I think, government officials need them, but just us run-of-the-mill Americans do not need visas.
You can get your visa card when you buy your ticket on the airplane to go to Managua.
Mine is not fully new. I didn't sort of put the word out of my mouth. The one thing I would say, my overwhelming emotion that just never ceased to kind of floor me was a real sense of humbling from being in Nicaragua. If you know much about the history of Nicaragua and you know much about the United States involvement, the fact that the current country was occupied for nearly 20 years by United States Marines, that a dictatorship that ruled the country for 40 years was set up by the United States, a lot of this thing, and they know that history very well, and they know the history of the United States and other parts of Latin America. To them, I was very nervous when I went to Nicaragua the first time, not for my safety, but I could not imagine a people that had been through this kind of history being willing to talk to me or being willing to be friendly with me. And I was just overwhelmed by the warmth and the love and the friendliness. I never ceased to amaze me the distinction the Nicaraguans would draw between the North American people and the North American government. I'm going to start speaking Spanish because I'm remembering all these conversations, but they would always say, el pueblo norteamericano es un buen pueblo. The North American people is a good people. And they would say, but we don't understand your government. And they would say, they would say, please go back and tell them what it is like, that your government is lying to you. And they have what really saddened me a lot, because I don't have as great a faith. They have tremendous faith in the North American people. Of commonality, of sisterhood and brotherhood, they feel with us. I mean, they, for one thing, they in Spanish is a little different than English, but in Spanish, an American is anybody who lives in North America or South America, because they're both the Americans. And they would always say, nosotros somos americanos, we're all Americans. They really feel that. And my contrast was having just come from a country that went through the crisis of the hostages in Iran, and the blind inability of my people to distinguish between the Iranian government and Iranian people, and watching what happened to Iranian people who were living in this country. When Iran has done so little to us, and then for me to go to a country like Nicaragua and be greeted with this tremendous warmth and hospitality and love, it was one of the most humbling and remains one of the most humbling experiences of my life.
I think that has something to do with us being raised where we all kind of come from the same class. I think an American has an advantage in the poor countries because in Peru, you're either poor or you're rich. And an American doesn't distinguish that much. You know, a poor person is just as good as a rich person, and a rich person can be just as lousy as a poor person. And we have something special to offer there, I think. We have a different viewpoint than a Peruvian or a Nicaraguan, because they think in terms of rich and poor. And they immediately put you into one of those classes, whereas we don't. We get to know the person first and then see what type of person they are.
I'm mindful of the fact that it's after 10 o'clock, and I think we can still take another question or two, but those of you who would like to call this wonderful, rich, long day to a close are welcome to do that.
I was just going to ask, is there a land reform program working?
Oh, in Nicaragua there certainly is, and that's an exciting one to see. Where the land is really being used quite productively by individual people as well as by the formation of cooperatives. One of Nicaragua's goals is to have a mixed economy. They want to have some things that are directed by the state and some that are directed by cooperatives and some that are in private enterprise. And they're basing the distinction on what makes the most economic sense for the particular commodity that's grown in that land. One of my most moving experiences was we visited a coffee plantation which had belonged to Somoza, one of many that belonged to Somoza. He never visited it in the 40 years that he lived in Nicaragua. It was a plantation on which there were 26 families, and when we came, they greeted us very warmly, and the first thing they showed us was the health clinic, which is there. It's a preventive health clinic, and a nurse comes a couple of times a week, and there's also a doctor available if necessary, and they talked with just great rapidity and excitement about the fact that the children were so much healthier now because of the clinic than they had been before the revolution. The second thing they showed us was the school, and the school was the supervisor's house that had been taken over and made into a school, and it was a school for the kids and a school for the adults, and literacy classes were going on for both. The third thing that they showed us was the new housing, and when we saw the houses, all of us Americans, I think, sort of gasped, because what we were looking at were cement block buildings, which were two rooms at most, with windows and doors, and tin roofs. They were very simple dwellings. In some cases, probably our animals on farms lived better than in those cement blocks. But then, and they were very proud of these, and very proud of the fact that in the last 3 years they had been able to build almost enough for all the families on the farm, and they were in the process of reaching that goal of having one for each family. The government had provided the materials, and the men had provided the labor to build them. We changed our opinion radically of their housing when we saw the way they had lived under Somoza. And it's hard to even describe it in a way maybe that will convey it to you, but they led us into a building which was a very large barn. It had a narrow aisle down the middle of it. It had no windows in it, no ventilation at all. It had simply a door at each end of the barn. The aisle was very narrow because both sides of the barn were taken up with stalls. The stalls were three on top of each other, and they had doors into each one with ladders so that you could crawl up to the second or the third stall. The stalls were 8 feet long, 4 feet high, and 4 feet deep. And it was in each one of these stalls that a whole family had lived during Somoza's time. Literally a whole family, a mother and father and all of their children, whether it was 2 or 10, had lived in one of these stalls. And that was their housing condition under Somoza. So that to them, the two-room cement buildings were a palace that they had all to themselves. They had a big kitchen where they cooked a lot communally, but the houses also had stoves so that if the women wanted to prepare food for their own family individually, is they could do that too. And they were just so excited and proud of this, of these developments in their life.
Now this was due to the land.
Let's take this question first.
Do you think that the spirit of this revolution or basic church and so forth is going to spread to the other countries in South America? And do you think that it is going to cause a reversal in the dictatorship that is there?
Well,
can they last if that type of a popular movement gets started in those countries? And will, standing question, do the U.S. policies, which are polarizing that area, cause us to develop a very large enemy, or a large number of enemies to the South?
One thing that may sound flip at first, but there's a saying in Latin America that the most important election in Latin America takes place in the United States every 4 years. And it's really true. It will depend a lot on what happens up here. I don't think it'll reverse the spirit. I think the spirit's irreversible, but it will determine how much bloodshed there will be. Nicaragua was very fortunate that their revolution occurred under Jimmy Carter. El Salvador hasn't been so lucky.
And still, they lost an astonishing number of people in Nicaragua, and the death continues. I mean, we were in the town of Leon the day after they had opened the Martyrs and Heroes Museum, where all of the people in that province who have died in the course of the revolution had their pictures, and it was just incredible to go in and see not only those who had lost their lives in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, but those who had lost their lives in June of 1983 from that province because they were fighting to defend their country.
Mine is not a question. It's just a recollection of a talk I heard from this famous Henry Nouwen, the Catholic theologian, in the talk about a month ago at Catholic University in Washington, D.C. And two things I just will contribute toward that thing. One of them was that he also talked with people in the streets and so in Nicaragua, and his impressions everywhere was that for the first time we have something to say about the government, about our lives. That's one thing. The other one was the youthful character of the leaders of the Nicaraguan government. And since you mentioned the youth, because he said he went to find the chief of police. And so he went down into a long hall into this building, and here was this young fellow in the hall somewhere, and he asked him, he said, "Can you tell me who the chief of police is?" And he said, "I'm the chief of police." He thought he was one of them. But it's the youthful character, and that also accounted, according to him, for some of the mistakes that were made.
Sure.
And that's probably the Indian thing, too, maybe in part of that, I don't know. So we have to kind of tolerate that and understand the leadership too.
Just a comment. One of the things that is often held up as a criticism of the Sandinista government is that they have not yet had an election. What we learned while we were down there is that the government has a commission of jurists who are in the process and have been for the last year and a half of visiting different electoral systems around the world to try to find out the best electoral system that will work for the situation in Nicaragua, going to Sweden and to England and to Germany and coming to the United States. And they are planning to have an election in 1985, unless the war just absolutely prevents them from that. And part of their literacy campaign, which began 6 months after the triumph over Somoza, was because they understand that you can't have a democracy unless you have educated people. And so this is their goal, is to have educated citizens in order to be able to make the decisions to run the country. They like to point out with kindness that the United States, after its revolution, did not have an election for 13 years, and even then we only had one candidate, and his name was George Washington.
I'm wondering what the amount of Soviet or Cuban presence or influence or what you experienced.
Do you want to comment on that, Chris?
We were there for a short a time I would say that we did not detect any Soviet or any Cuban presence at all, other than the fact that the government officials told us that there were approximately 3,500 Cubans that are involved in primarily healthcare and educational activities as volunteers or at least offering to those in education and healthcare. And we did not hear numbers about Cuban military. If there were any, they were undoubtedly small. Joel Muggy, who has been there several times over the past 2 years, he's probably there 25% of his time, he's gone on about 9 trips over 2 years, has said that he has not seen any Russians at all, any Soviets at all, and if they are, then they're off somewhere else. I think their presence has been relatively small. At least until the time that we were there. That may be picking up. I don't know.
We asked the public relations officer for the chief staff, would be the equivalent, about the Russian and Cuban presence, and he said, "Look around you. Do you see them?" He said, "We are not a very big country, and you've been in many of our major cities. Have you seen them?" He said, "Where would we hide the number of Russians and Cubans that your press say we have?" He said, "Just look around you." And he said, "The other thing is that we have Russians and Cubans come on technical missions. When we buy material from them, we contract with the government to send the people to train us how to use that equipment. And as soon as they've trained us how to use the equipment, they go home. Because we have learned that when they stay in the country, they just stir up trouble." And he said with a little grin, he said, "We've discovered that the best relations with the Soviet Union are the ones at a distance."
Let me just say one thing, and then I think we really have to close this down. But as far as the Russian-Cuban question, it's undoubtable that Nicaragua has and will continue to buy machinery and so forth from the East Bloc countries and Soviet Union and Cuba and so forth. And we can thank ourselves primarily for that. Up until 1979, Nicaragua was basically a client state of the United States. All of its economy was built on United States machinery. Now we have an economic boycott, basically, of the country. One thing you do see is buses that are not running because there are no parts to replace them. Nicaragua is in the process of having to change its total economic infrastructure because it cannot count on anything to keep its machinery as the whole system going. And so, sure, there are going to be more East Bloc things there, and they don't have any choices. Mm-hmm.
Thank you all for coming.